with 10 MPs average time is 20 minutes. So kindly try and make your argument, everything within those within that.
This is Louis Cochran. I'm legal counsel at the JNC. I'm joined by my colleagues, Ms. Linda De Beer, who will assist with technical matters if there were to be any questions, and our Director of Issuer Services, Mr. John Burke, who on a day-to-day basis deals with companies and the regulation of companies, and more particularly listed companies. Firstly, we would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to discuss and address various comments that we have with the company's bill. We would like to commend the DTI for the manner in which it considered and successfully incorporated all the previous comments and principles that are of great importance to the company's bill to significantly improve the legislation, more particularly insofar as the categorization of companies is concerned. Our submission focuses primarily on matters of principle, and I will discuss that firstly and thereafter some general comments, and might then discuss and invite your attention to the various matters of principle that we have raised. The first matter of principle is the Financial Reporting Standards Council. The JSC is concerned that the functions of this council have been scaled down significantly from what is included in the Corporate Laws Amendment Act to an advisory function only to the Minister, as opposed to being a standard setter, as was discussed initially, and we were told that that was the goal, that this council should be a standard setter. The structure of this standard setting function is of concern to the JSC, especially insofar as the time is issuing of financial reporting standards is concerned. We are of the view that it is unlikely that standard setting can be done through ministerial approval process in a speedy manner. We do recognise the attempt of the DTI to create a mechanism in the bill to fast-track the issuing of financial reporting standards, such as is set out in section 223, bracket 3 of the bill. However, the Achilles heel of this process remains that this provision calls for ministerial approval, and it is anticipated that it would only be implemented in exceptional circumstances. If South African companies in general, and more particularly listed companies on the JSE, do not adopt the revised International Financial Reporting Standards very soon after being issued internationally, the situation is created where South African companies might not be in compliance with the Companies Act if they have adopted the new IFRS standards, due to the fact that these standards have not yet been able to go to the full local due process of approval and issuance. This particular issue is of vital importance to the JSC as regulator of the exchange, as an integral aspect of the JSC's status as the investment destination of choice is its listings requirements and the very stringent financial reporting standards that are set by these requirements. The listings requirements currently and will remain to incorporate IFRS by reference. Therefore, it's a simple standard for listed companies to meet. They have to meet IFRS as that is changed from time to time. The JSC has and will adopt the new revised International Financial Reporting Standards as soon as they are issued to ensure that the JSC's listed companies remain subject to international standards and best practice, and as such, the JSC will offer the best possible protection to international and local investors. For example, in this last year, there have been 20 changes to the IFRS reporting standards. And if we have to wait for ministerial approval and legislation in the form of government gazette to change these standards, it will be firstly time-consuming and in our view impractical to submit and subject companies to these standards. And we are of the view that this process is going to lead to various consequences that we believe were not intended by the bill. If these companies do not adopt the IFRS standards immediately, they cannot claim compliance with IFRS, which has a major impact on the credibility of South Africa's financial reporting. IFRS is a comprehensive reporting framework, and it's not possible to switch from one comprehensive accounting framework such as IFRS to the next. The implication there would be that companies would have to redo prior year figures on the other framework for the sake of comparative information. Furthermore, auditors will have to reconsider the revised information for purposes of expressing an audit opinion. Not only would this result in unnecessary and fruitless costs, be hugely confusing for shareholders, local and international investors and other users of these financial statements. We would like to point out that other standard setting functions, such as the auditing standards, are not done in a similar fashion. And we are of the view that the promulgation of legislation is an inappropriate and ineffective manner to align South Africa's financial reporting standards with international best practice. We acknowledge the comment from the DTI that the Minister cannot delegate powers to set financial reporting standards to the Financial Reporting Standards Council or to any other body, as the standard setting function is in law and in fact a lawmaking ability. This unfortunately is the unintended consequence of the Corporate Laws Amendment Act and the Company Bill providing legal backing for accounting standards, a matter that has been requested for many years. Legal backing indeed enables enforcement of compliance with these standards and put appropriate processes and procedures in place for legal action to be taken against companies and their office bearers in instances of non-compliance with the required standards. This being said, we reiterate our view that the legislative process of promulgation in terms of the Act is unsuitable for and will not keep up with a multitude of changes of IFRS. And we would like to point out that this is done on an annual basis. We understand that a conflict will arise in an attempt to attain legal backing for financial reporting standards on the one hand and achieve a speedy standard setting process delegated to an independent standard setting body, such as the Financial Reporting Standards Council on the other. We would therefore like to suggest as a solution that the balance be struck between these objectives without jeopardizing the credibility of South African financial reporting. The criminalization of non-compliance with these accounting standards promulgated in terms of the Companies Bill is furthermore not the appropriate sanction for transgressions that have never before been considered to be criminal acts. Due to the fact that these standards are not part of the statute, the sanction is that any transgression thereof will be considered to be a criminal offence. Just as a general example, in terms of the general accepted accounting practice in South Africa, segmental information has to be disclosed. And if it's not done, it is indeed a transgression of GOB and then of IFRS. But surely such a transgression should never be considered to be a criminal offence and the consequences that follow with that. The JSC is of the view that the current common law and statutory offences in South African law creates a comprehensive framework of prohibited actions and sanctions against those actions. And these offences and the current legislation will be sufficient to punish offences that are considered to be of a criminal nature. And a ready example would be fraud. If any accountant or auditor fraudulently failed to disclose information in financial statements, he will be guilty of fraud, and as such, that would be a criminal offence without making those standards criminal offences in terms of the Act. We are therefore of the view that we model where the criminalisation of certain actions would remain, such as the case in the current regime, but that the criminalisation of non-compliance would not be the only way to achieve the legal backing. We suggest that administrative action and administrative sanction should be the primary methods of enforcing these reporting standards, in addition to the fact that many transgressions would also be considered to constitute criminal offences, such as fraud or corruption or the like. The criminal offence route should not be the only standard or the only sanction that may be a cumbersome remedy to enforce transgressions of these financial reporting standards. The enforcement of the financial reporting standards will only be adequately addressed if done in a timely manner, and we are of the view that the criminal courts will never be able to address these offences in a timely manner. The normal process would have to be followed. A complaint laid at the various police stations, a charge with the police, and followed up to the National Prosecuting Authority. For offences that are of the most of a very technical nature, and offences that not in the past have been considered to be of a criminal nature at all, but would merely be a failure to meet accounting standards. The South African Police Services and National Prosecuting Authority will be further burdened by further statutory offences, and the goal to set legal backing for the accounting standards would not be served by moving the enforcement of accounting services over to the National Prosecuting Authorities or to the police. We are of the view that the goal to ensure legal backing for accounting standards should be delegated to another body, such as the Financial Reporting Standards Council, and these standards will then be enforced by administrative action and sanction. We would like to note an example that we work on a daily basis in terms of the Security Services Act, where there are prohibited actions such as insider trading, market manipulation and the like, and then primarily enforcement of these transgressions are done by the Enforcement Committee of the Financial Services Board in the way of administrative sanction and financial penalties. It is so that these transgressions may also be considered to be a criminal offence, but the criminal offence is not the primary method of enforcement. So we would suggest a dual manner in which to achieve this legal backing for the accounting standards. My second point of principle is the issue of the monitoring of compliance with financial reporting standards. One of the urgent and long overdue amendments addressing the Corporate Laws Amendment Act was the implementation of a monitoring function to ensure compliance with financial reporting standards, especially in companies where public interest plays a large role. This is an important element in the legislative framework for confidence in the quality of reporting by our companies and hence enhances the credibility of our markets. It's concerning that the bill makes no mention of the Corporate Laws Amendment Act reference to the proactive review of financial statements. And we have been told that the DTI is of the view that this should best be dealt by the Commission for Companies and Intellectual Property. We suggest that it would be the most appropriate place to deal with this would be in the Act itself, and we suggest that Section 191 be expanded to also allow for the Minister to appoint a specialist committee of appropriately qualified individuals to address the objectives and function of the Commission, as contemplated by Section 186 1B and D, and Section 187 2B, 3A and B of the Bill. We suggest that there be that specific reference be made to the following: monitoring of compliance with financial reporting standards, proactive identification of contraventions of financial reporting standards, investigations of alleged contravention of financial reporting standards, and the appropriate remedial and other action in respect of such contraventions. My last point of principle is the issue of the role of shareholders in the board of directors as regulated by the Companies Bill. The JSE is of the view that it is an important and vital corporate governance principle, not only in South Africa but in international jurisdictions, that a company's affairs are managed by its shareholders and the board of directors that are appointed by the shareholders to execute the mandate of the company as set out in the memorandum and the articles of association. The board of directors are responsible to be good stewards of the company and accountable to the shareholders as they take the ultimate responsibility to steer, direct and lead the company and its management. The JSC is of the view that the following provisions of the Companies Bill are not allowed with these principles. The first one, Section 66(4B), that implies that shareholders can, on election of the company in its memorandum of incorporation, only appoint 50% of the directors. It is uncertain in such an instance who would appoint the other 50%. And the JSC is of the view that, in line with well-recognized international corporate governance principles, all directors should be directed by the shareholders. It is evident that the Audit Committee, that is in some instances a subcommittee of the board, and accountable to the board insofar as fulfilling its functions relating to financial supporting, internal controls and risk of concern, have been assigned superpower, and instances are created in the bill where the Audit Committee is directly accountable to the shareholders insofar as audit independence is concerned. This creates an inherently conflicting role and reporting line, and it contradicts the corporate governance principle that I referred to earlier. Those conclude my principal comments, a few minor comments. Firstly, the definition of a group of companies. The bill defines a group of companies as two or more companies that are related or interrelated, and the bill furthermore contains numerous references to a group, for example, when conducting a solvency and liquidity test. This definition is contradictory to what is commonly understood to be a group, and also the definition of a group in terms of the financial reporting standard. In both of these instances, a group refers to different legal entities that share common control. The definition of the bill is much wider and has significant unintended consequences that would be impossible to execute in practice. My second point in the minor comments is the shareholding of a company. Section 25.1b requires that a company must at all times have at least one share issued to at least one person that is other than a company that is part of the same group of companies. This implies that a company cannot be only a subsidiary of another company. We question the rationale for this requirement as completely out of step with current requirements, and there seems to be no valid reason for such a requirement. My next minor point is the impact on the changes in financial year ends. We question why section 27.4c, that requires a company may not have a financial year any more than 15 months after the preceding financial year. This requirement is not in line with that of the current requirement, which allows for 18 months. The 15-month limitation may be problematic in instances where a company changes its year-end. For example, if a company with a February year-end becomes a subsidiary of a company with a June year-end, the new holding company would require the subsidiary to change its year-end in order to simplify reporting. This will result in the subsidiary having a 4-month financial period to June, and it would not be allowed to have a 16-month financial period from March to June 2009. This would place a cost and effort burden on such a company as if they have 2 year-ends in a short space of time, and disregards the importance of allowing companies to continue with reasonable commercial activity. We question the importance of requiring that the length of the initial financial period be aligned with subsequent periods. My last comment is the status of the JSE's listing requirements in relation to the company's goals. The current situation is that all companies have to comply with the Companies Act, and that the listing requirements are additional requirements that companies have to meet for their securities qualified for listing on the JSE. In the event of any conflict between the companies, the listing requirements will take precedence, as the JSE is entitled to regulate those companies in a more stringent manner due to the amount of investment that those companies normally attract. There is no general statement in the bill to explain the status of the JSE's listing requirements, other than the very specific and narrow application Section 84.2 is found in Chapter 2 of the Bill and deals with auditor, company secretary and audit committees. And it's only in these instances which the Act states that in the event of a conflict, the listing requirements will take precedence. If we apply the application of interpretation of statutes that by including the one, it excludes the rest, could lead to an interpretation that the JSE listing requirements will only take precedence to the provisions of the Companies Bill in respect of the narrowly defined issues as stated in Section 84.2. These issues are of minor importance regarding company secretary, audit committees and the auditor, and the listing requirements regulate much more than those issues. We therefore request that the reference in Section 84.2 be deleted completely, as if it's not stated that the listing requirements will take precedence, the normal legal points will follow, in that the listing requirements are terms of agreement between the company, and that the JSE may prescribe more stringent listing requirements than those in the company's bill. If a company then lists on the JSE, those requirements would be applicable on the company and not the company's bill itself. Mr. Chairman, those are my submissions. I'm ready to take any questions or comments from the honourable members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Members, time for comments, questions. In regard to your 1.4, your second sentence, we are of the view that the promulgation of legislation is an inappropriate and ineffective manner to align South African financial reporting standards with international best practice. It's a broad statement. In the latter half of your contribution, you are more concrete with suggestions. It would have been helpful in this instance if you were more forthcoming. What do you suggest in place? So you can think about that. To provide examples and alternatives, the broad statements, they are helpful, but they only help us up to a certain degree. Comrade Susan Chigala.
Thanks, Ken. Just on the issue of the IFRS, as well, in 1.8, reference is made to criminalization. It is just a pity that there are no specific references to the deal that are made there. Therefore, my input would be much more general as well. My understanding is that DTI has tried that it can be decriminalized. Quite a number of unnecessary instances where they were criminalized in the current act. But one would have assumed that anything that is left, would really warrant to be categorized as something that needs or should be defined as a criminal offense. If you could, respond that do you still feel that the use of non-compliance should have been decriminalized as part of some of the instances that DTI has already decriminalized? Number one. Number two, at the beginning you make reference to non-compliance, but down the line you make reference to transgression. Now, would that be the same? Sometimes one is cautious about legal, terminology, because my off-the-cuff reaction is that it may not necessarily be transgression, as I may guess are more serious actions, which therefore would warrant CAFA function. With regard to 2.3 in monitoring of non-compliance or of compliance, you make reference that the indications from DTI that this could be dealt by the commission, but then one would assume that somehow that should be spelled out within the deal. Can you clarify that? If you see that there's something that has been spelled out in the committee in the deal, or is still an unclear grey area? Your proposal just below that is also regarding the appointment of a specialist committee by the minister. Now the question I have is that once the specialist committee is appointed, whom does it relate to? Is it appointed to report to the minister, or is it appointed to relate to the commission? On shareholding, that is regarding 5 in page 4 on a detailed comment. You say that the introduction of section 25.1b, is completely out of depth with the current requirements. This will just help us. What are the current requirements? And as the chair has already said, with regards to the last 0.7 on the JSC distinct requirement, I would be more also suggestive that if you could come up with some remedy, then a remedy that you see, because it's a bit of a concern if JSC would from time to time come up with listing requirements which are more stringent than what are contained in a piece of legislation. Thanks.
Thank you. Your time for your enjoyment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad that I'll attempt to answer 6 of the 7 myself, and I'll refer one to my colleague, Mr. Beer, regarding the Audit Committee. The initial comment made regarding the standard setting by way of static is just by its very nature. That's why I mentioned the example of IFRS. Accounting standards change yearly, and it is done due to the fact that our technical nature and people in practice, in accounting practice, look at what's best practice, what would be the best manner in which to report these transactions or figures or the like. This is done by IFRS. They can do it quickly. They can do it in direct answer to various needs of the industry. And the JSC's listing requirements incorporate these standards by reference. Therefore, we say all companies have to comply with IFRS. That's it. The ministerial approval process is by its very nature not suited to that, because any act, what we are doing here is we are promulgating acts of parliament. That has to be done in terms of the constitution in a specific manner. Therefore, the act gives the minister certain powers. The minister then has to promulgate the legislation by way of government gazette. Government gazette has to be published for comments, and only when the government gazette is then published does that become take the force of law, and then the requirements are set. The difference between setting requirements through IFRS immediately and the difference of setting that by way of statute is enormous. And just the very nature of the legislative process does not lead itself to an economic and efficient manner in which to set financial reporting standards such as this. And that is my point. We then went on to suggest that the way to enforce that would be a hybrid of criminal and administrative sanction, and that will be part of the second question that the Honourable Member of the Committee has asked me, where, yes, indeed, certain transgressions of those or failure to meet those requirements will be considered to be criminal actions, but that cannot be the only way to enforce them. That is the problem with the current Act. Where we have the example being the Security Services Act, we have the Registrar of Security Services who appoints an enforcement committee who takes immediate administrative action against insider trading, front running, market manipulation, the market abuse sections of the Security Services Act. That is coupled with a financial penalty to the persons that have suffered loss as a result of that action. And furthermore, that may still lead to criminal action. In this Act, we only have the criminal action. That as the only sanction, and that in our view would not be effective to punish transgressions of people failing to meet these requirements sufficiently and with the requisite speed. Regarding the shelving of the company, member's second last question, currently there are no requirements that a company must have at least one natural person as a shareholder. Therefore, one company may own another company. Now he's saying that's not permissible anymore. So the whole company structure and corporate structure of the holding company with a subsidiary would have to fall away, because that subsidiary would have to have one national shareholder. And we see no reason to have such a prohibition against the commercial practice of wholly owned companies that have been in South Africa and internationally recognized for many, many years. And we therefore request that specific requirement to be scrapped. The last question was what we suggest the JSE to do regarding the listings requirement, is that the reference in 84.2 that the listings requirements will only take precedence in respect of those issues enunciated in section 84.2 should be removed in its entirety. That would mean that the current legal position will continue to exist, and that is that firstly all companies have to comply with the company's bill, because those are the minimum requirements. The JSE is allowed to prescribe any additional listings requirements that are more stringent and not in conflict with the Act, and companies would have to comply with those requirements in the event of a conflict, and that's only for listed companies. So it's a very specific request that the JSC still be allowed to set more stringent requirements than those requirements in the companies bill, and in the event of a conflict, only pertaining to listed companies, that other things requirements will take precedence. I think that covers the 6 out of the 7 questions, and Mr. Beer will deal with the specialist committee that on the
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the specialist committee and the monitoring function, maybe just to clarify our recommendation is, at the moment in the Corporate Laws Amendment Act, as is stated in paragraph 2.2, provision is made for a monitoring function, and that has been completely removed in the bill, so there's no reference to any monitoring function, which we believe is quite important, not for every single company, but definitely where public interest is concerned. In other words, our recommendation is that the bill at least creates an enabler within the legislation itself for the Commission to set up such a monitoring function on a proactive basis at least, or also to deal with complaints regarding the financial reporting of the bigger companies, of the public companies. And that the reporting would fit within the Commission, and obviously that the report back and the action would be dealt with, whether it's administrative or otherwise, by the Commission. Very similar or in line with what is currently suggested and recommended in the Amendment Act.
Thank you very much, good folks. I would like to go to the independent Regulatory Board of Auditors. As soon as you are ready, let's go for it. Time is not our friend today.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity for the Independent Regulatory Board for auditors to do this presentation to you this morning. And on behalf of the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, to congratulate the DTI on developing legislation which aims to be clear, facilitating, transparent, and predictable. My name is Bernard Legalis. I'm the Acting Chief Executive Officer of the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, and I'm accompanied by my colleague, Sandy Van Esch, who is the Technical Director at the RBA at the moment. Let me start by explaining that our comments have been sent to you. You've received a detailed comment letter from the RBA, and we've also sent a short presentation. I will focus today on the principal issues only, and I won't go into too much detail on the detail that we have provided to the DTI or to the committee. Those go into quite a few pages, and I won't cover those in the presentation today. I will only deal with matters of principle this morning. Let me start off by also saying that the mandate of the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors is to protect the public interest, and I'd like you to hear our comments this morning in the light of our mandate to protect the public interest and understand in what context we have made these comments. I'll start off with explaining just who exactly the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, or the RBA, is. We are the statutory regulator for the auditing profession in South Africa. We have a statutory mandate provided by the Auditing Profession Act, Act No. 26 of 2006, and we are also, in terms of that Act, we are the national standard setter for auditing standards and for review standards. In fact, we are the standard setter for all assurance standards issued in South Africa. In terms of our legislation, we're also expected to issue a code of ethics for auditors, and I mention that because in some of the comments that I will make later that appear in your, or some of the sections in your bill has an effect on what auditors do, and it touches on the code of ethics that we have to issue as the RBA. The mandate of the RBA is also to promote investment and employment in South Africa, and as I mentioned earlier, the protection of minority interests, which I believe is consistent with what the committee wants to achieve with its current legislation. Let me also try and explain to the committee that what the difference is between a chartered accountant, because you'll hear presentations this morning, and you might have heard some others, on from professional bodies and the services that they provide. But I also need to explain that when you are a registered auditor, registered with the RBA, then it's a very different type of accountant in the sense that the Act only allows those type of accountants to express assurance on any of the services that they provide. So that would be the difference between a chartered accountant, for example, and a registered auditor. Before anybody can express any assurance in South Africa, they have to be registered with the board, and that is strictly to protect the public. It's important also to understand that the RBA adopted the International Standards on Auditing on the 1st of January 2005. And that is quite important because that means that any audit performed in South Africa can be understood by anybody internationally. Any report issued by a registered auditor in South Africa is issued in terms of International Standards on Auditing or International Standards on Reviews, and those are therefore anybody internationally will understand exactly what those reports explain. So although we're there, the RBA does not exist to protect auditors. We have to support auditors to ensure that they can perform audits and thereby indirectly protect the public interest. We report directly to the Minister of Finance. The matter of principle that I want to cover this morning very briefly is the independent review of financial statements, the maintenance of accounting records, financial reporting standards, preparation of annual financial statements, and then the rotation of auditors. I'll start off with the independent review of financial statements. In the legislation, it's provided in Section 31, in Section 3010, that the categories of private companies required to have their financial statements audited and the manner, form, and procedures for an independent review engagement other than an audit, as well as the professional qualifications of those persons that can do those reviews, will be determined in regulation by the Minister. Now, the comment that we'd like to make is that when that does happen, when the Minister does issue those regulations, that the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors should probably be consulted, because that is, in fact, what we mandated to do in terms of the Auditing Profession Act, to issue those standards, and whether they audit standards or review standards. We support the provisions in the bill, which requires all companies not to necessarily have an audit, but to have something which we refer to as an alternate assurance service. And such alternate assurance service in terms of the bill is referred to as a review. Now, what is very important is that such a review, we would request that the committee seriously consider what they want to achieve with such a review, and not to compare to what is done or the report that is made in terms of a closed corporation, or when an accounting officer issues a report in terms of a closed corporation. It must be borne in mind that when that report is issued, no assurance is expressed by the accounting officer. And we believe that although a company might not need an audit with a very high level of assurance, which we refer to as reasonable assurance, some kind and some level of assurance needs to be expressed, otherwise the public won't be protected. And in our review standard, that would be referred to not as reasonable assurance, but as limited assurance. Those reviews are not as detailed as an audit, but they are certainly governed by review standards issued by the RBA, which is based, or in fact is exactly the same as the International Review Standard. Because we were anticipating that an alternative assurance service will be available in South Africa in terms of the company's bill, we have now also started to participate in an international project by the International Federation of Accountants. We do a lot of work in drafting and assisting them to draft the international auditing standards, and they are in the process of reviewing their review standards, for alternate assurance service, and we are on that committee to assist them, because I think we can get quite a lot of benefit to use such a standard in South Africa. It is very important to the RBA as a standard setter and to protect the public that whatever that review standard will entail, that it is a recognized standard and that it's issued by a recognized standard setter. That is so that there can be credibility not only locally for anybody who relies on those reports or those review reports, but also internationally. And if they are performed in terms of international standards, then even internationally anybody can rely on those reports. That doesn't mean that only members of the RBA at stand at the moment can provide the service. I need to inform the committee that in terms of our Auditing Profession Act, there is an accreditation provision which allows for the RBA to accredit other institutions that comply with our standards. This provision was specifically included or requested by the Minister of Finance because he wants to open the profession, the auditing profession, to more institutes. At the moment, only one institute is accredited by the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, and that is the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. But if anybody wants to do an audit, or anybody who wants to perform this review in terms of the Act, they will be able to do that, provided that such institute registers or gets accredited by the RBA. We believe that it's important that everybody complies with the same audit and review standards, otherwise the public will be confused and ultimately they won't be protected. What is also important to know is that in terms of our Auditing Profession Act, which is quite strong and has been strengthened since the 1st of April 2006 when it was implemented, we also have provisions for auditors reporting what we refer to as a reportable irregularity. Such reportable irregularities are clearly defined in our legislation, and that means that an auditor has the responsibility to report anything irregular as a client. So whether there's an audit or a review, the auditor will have to report that to us. And again, that is in terms of the Minister's expectation that there must be some measures out there to try and curb white-collar crime. So all of those reports do come to the RBA. And for an auditor that does not report a report with regularity, there are heavy penalties which include 10 years in prison or a fine of about 200,000 rand. All registered auditors are subject to an inspection process, and if the inspection process to see whether they comply with the standards, whether that's audit standards or review standards, but they're also subject to comply with the Code of Professional Ethics that will be issued by the RBA. In terms of our Act, we have to develop a Code of Ethics, and auditors that do not comply with that Code of Ethics will be subject to disciplinary action and could be struck off the roll. We believe that it's very important to protect the public, that anybody performing services in the public interest must be subject to those measures. Let me talk about my next principal point, which is on accounting records, and just very briefly mention that it appears to us that the legislation is written to only require accounting records to be kept by certain companies, certain categories of companies. We believe that it's important that for accountability purposes and good corporate governance, that all companies should be required to keep accounting records. Again, if the provision that affects a company to keep accounting records suddenly kicks in, the company at least needs to have something to start off with. And it is just very good for good corporate governance principles. As far as financial reporting standards are concerned, we know that the current bill makes provision for reporting standards to be consistent with International Financial Reporting Standards, or IFRS. Now, it's very important that whatever framework we use in South Africa is recognized, and that recognition will have a direct impact on the credibility of financial reporting in South Africa. I've already mentioned that we use international standards on auditing, and that makes our reports very credible. But such reports are issued in terms of a financial reporting framework, and it's also very important that such a financial reporting framework to be issued by the Financial Reporting Standards Council must be recognized and must be an acceptable financial reporting standards framework. This is so because an auditor cannot express an opinion on a framework that is not recognized locally or internationally.
We are also not sure whether the role of the Financial Reporting Services Council is that of advising the minister or actually setting the standards. We believe it's very important that there is a proper standard-setting process. And we don't only base that on what happens internationally with setting international financial reporting standards, but also what happens internationally and locally with the setting of auditing standards. We follow a very specific process, a very important process, to issue those auditing standards, and we believe that as a standard setter, there should also be the ability from the standard setter to issue not only the standards, but also guidance and circulars to guide and to help the people that will have to implement those standards. We also note from the legislation that in section 204, the responsibility is, as I mentioned earlier, to advise the minister, but we believe that the whole process of setting standards should be coordinated by the Financial Reporting Services Council. We also note that there are regulations to be issued regarding financial reporting standards, and we would just advise or request that when those are issued, that a due process is followed so that everybody can comment on it. My third matter of principle relates to the preparation of annual financial statements. Again, there seems to be, or there is a provision that doesn't require the preparation of financial statements for every company. Even though those financial statements might not be subject to audit, we believe that it's important that such financial statements are prepared. Again, that would be for good governance, for purposes of good governance, and also just for accountability. The fact that somebody doesn't have to have an audit, which already takes some accountability away from the directors, and we do support that. We do not believe that every small company needs an audit, but we do believe that for some kind of accountability, there needs to be a set of financial statements prepared. Chairman, my last item of principle that I wanted to refer to was the rotation of auditors and the removal of auditors. We do note that there is no longer a provision in the current bill to deal with removal of auditors, and we also note what the provisions are regarding the rotation of auditors. Now again, to remind the committee, the Auditing Profession Act specifically requires a committee for auditor ethics to be formed, and in 2006 when our act was implemented, the board formed a committee for auditor ethics. The composition of that board, of that committee, is clearly prescribed in our legislation. One of the first priorities of that committee was to issue a code of ethics, and that code will deal with, amongst others, the rotation of auditors, but in more general principles, that code deals with independence requirements. At the moment, the independence requirements are based on the International Federation of Accountants independence requirements, and that part of the code consists of about 90 to 120 pages, which means that independence is addressed in the code of ethics. I mentioned earlier that auditors are subject to this code, and auditors that do not comply will be disciplined. They will be inspected on this code of ethics. In fact, when the Corporate Laws Amendment Bill was issued, the DTI specifically required us to finalize this code because there was reference to independence in the CRAA as well. Our code will be approved by the board as an exposure draft on the 20th of August, and it will be out for public exposure probably after October this year, and we're hoping to expose it for a period of 4 months. And in terms of that code, we would have covered in a lot of detail the independence requirements, rotation, etc., of auditors. We just asked the committee to please bear in mind then that it would help if the bill was consistent with international best practice on independence principles, as well as what will appear in the auditing profession code of ethics. Otherwise, it might cause confusion to auditors. For example, at the moment, the bill requires a 5-year rotation period, while internationally it's 7 years, and a cooling off period of 2 years locally, whereas internationally it's, currently, your bill requires 5 years, and in fact it is 2 years internationally. And whatever is in the bill, we just request the committee seriously to consider whether it's consistent with international best practice and with the code of ethics to be issued by the RBA. Chairman, some of the detailed comments, which you will find in our letter. Sandy just reminded me to also mention specifically that we have got a section that deals with definitions and some confusion and some definitions that are not consistent with other legislation. One of them is the definition of auditor and designated auditor. Those are used interchangeably in the bill.
But besides the fact that we need some clarification on what is meant by that, it also needs to be consistent with how an auditor is defined in the Auditing Profession Act. In the Auditing Profession Act, an auditor could include an individual person or a firm. And this is very important, again, for us to clarify what is meant by an auditor, because if an auditor was going to be held liable for any action, it is also important for us not to limit it to the individual auditor, but also extend it to the firm. So it's important that you also remember to ensure that your definitions are consistent, or at least clarified in what is meant by auditor and then designated auditor. Some of the individual comments, as I mentioned, the specific ones have been made by our previous colleagues, and they are available in our letter. Thank you, Chairman, and we can take any questions.
Thank you very much. Comment, questions, members? Could you kindly switch off here? Thanks for your input. Can we go to SAIPA? You may commence as soon as you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Honorable Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Shahid Daniels, Chief Executive of SAIPA. I'd like to introduce my colleague sitting next to me. On my right hand side is Lerato Sebata, the chairperson of a subcommittee on corporate law. On my far left is Nicholas Van Wyk, Technical Executive on standards and technical. And then on my right left next to me is Professor Farooq Kassim, corporate law expert. Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee, our African Institute of Professional Accountants sincerely appreciates the opportunity to address the committee with a view of to first applauding the task team for a task well done, and secondly to raise a number of concerns that we feel should be considered in the bill before it is enacted. It is our view that addressing these concerns will further strengthen the bill in achieving the desired outcome. Chairperson, SAIPA has, as it is evident from our submission, consulted widely among corporate law experts before compiling our submission. Finally, SAIPA wishes to thank the committee well in its deliberations and is confident that the Act will emerge from these deliberations that will best serve our country in the next phase of our corporate law development. I thank you, and I'll ask Lerato Sebata to say a few words on who we really are from as a professional body.
Thanks, Sahi. And thank you, Chairperson, and all the committees that are present. SAIPA, or SAIPA, it's short for South African Institute of Professional Accountants. It is the second largest accounting institute in South Africa. It has 6,000 members in practice, commerce, industry, and government. Approximately 20% of its members are black, And it has 1,500 students ready to write paper evaluation. It's accredited with the finance sector. SIPA is a full member of IFAC, and that is the International Federation of Accountants, and also the Eastern Central and Southern African Federation of Accountants. SIPA's qualifications are registered at a level 7 of the National Qualifications Authority. SIPA members are commissioners of all in terms of legislation. SIPA sets mandatory requirements for all its members with regards to continuing professional education and subscription to professional indemnity insurance. SIPA members perform function and issue reports in terms of lending industry regulation, sectional title, non-profit organization act, school act, as well as close corporation. Amongst our goals as SIPA is to establish the institution as the globally preferred accountancy institute of choice, regularly benchmark the formal and informal training the institute provides to its members and non-members against local and international best practice, and to enhance the sharing of knowledge, skills and expertise between employees, members, thereby creating abundance of mentality. One of our values and goals as well is to ensure that the institute is optimally equipped to contribute to the efficiency of the African economy, thereby providing a sound financial management across all the economy of South Africa. Our values are integrity, reliable, trustworthy, credible, and sincere. I would like to hand over to Nicolas van Dijk.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for this opportunity. Our presentation, just to ensure that everybody has one, we'll just bring a few copies along. It's also presented on the PowerPoint slide on the screen. And the presentation, although it looks a bit hefty, contains various sections. It also contains a PowerPoint slide right at the back of the document, which we will follow. It also includes an appendix section. The appendix section includes proposals for amendments to the bill. If our proposals are accepted. There's a few appendices at the back of the document. It further highlights the point which we would like to address. And then our submission has two basic parts. But before we start, the first slide just indicates that who is today present in presenting to Parliament. There's our committee members that assisted us. We had a very in-depth process of commenting, and our submission contains two sections, a specific discussion on relevant sections relevant to our profession, the accounting profession. This deals mainly with financial reporting and reporting on financial statements, and also service providers, persons that can issue those reports. Then our submission moves into a general conceptual discussion. We felt that we have a responsibility to comment on various other sections that might not specifically relate to our organization or our interests, but to assist the DTI in putting forth a piece of legislation that can enhance our economy. So our specific proposals relate to five different main headings. The first one is financial statements. Then we're going to discuss reports on financial statements and who can issue those. We'll have a look at Financial Reporting Standards Council. We're going to make a proposal on the closed corporation. And lastly, we're going to discuss penalties. The page 5 of our submission contains a summary of our main issues. So for those of you who would like to have an easier reference, page 5 contains the main summary. What we propose is improvements with regard to accounting records, recognition of financial statement report providers. We wish to discuss the scope and type of independent review proposed. We wish to link their presentation directly with financial reporting standards. We want to request that the differential financial reporting standards be appropriately addressed in the legislation to provide also for micro-entity financial reporting. And also we're going to ask for an effective and efficient issuing process. We'll also be requesting a relook at the Close Corporation Act and its future existence. Also a very important part, the penalty. Page 7 of our submission includes a model on our specific proposal. We kind of condensed or extracted what's presented in our submission into page 7, and that brings us to the main assumption based on which our arguments are based, and that is that the company bill provides for different types of companies in one bill. As such, different provisions should apply to different companies. So one approach would not work, and it's a very difficult process, but necessary to highlight those differences. If we then move on to our slide presentation, we will be discussing financial statements and what we propose there too. The financial statement is very important, and our main request there is that financial statements should be mandatory for all companies. The current bill proposes an exemption for owner-managed companies. We believe, however, that all companies should be required to prepare financial statements. This will be similar to current provisions in both the Company Act as well as the Close Corporation Act. Our reason for this is that the establishment of differential financial reporting standards will make it easier for companies, less costly and less burdensome to provide financial statements. We foresee three levels of differential financial reporting: IFRS, which is the International Financial Reporting Standard, or South African GAAP, which should be applicable to public companies. Then, currently internationally, there's a discussion on IFRS for SME or GAAP for SME. We foresee that standard, and in agreement with the organization that designed IFRS for SME, we believe that only non-owner managed companies with a particular public interest who should be required to follow IFRS for SME. And it's important to note the designers of IFRS for SME did not intend the standard to be applicable to owner-managed companies. It's in the discussion papers and clearly stated. We foresee a third standard to be developed, which is referred to as micro-entity financial reporting standards, and we would like to request the DCI perhaps relook at the provisions with regard to financial reporting standards. We know that they accepted the principle of differentiation. We just don't see that the bill clearly addressed the three levels. So we're discussing the reasons why we're asking for mandatory financial statements. The first one was differential reporting standards is accepted. Secondly, the business rescue provisions will enable companies, when a financial distress indicator arises, to apply business rescue provisions. We support those provisions and also support that it should remain in the company's bill. We've read some other proposals that we should see that outside. We believe the business rescue provisions should remain within the bill, and we support those provisions with its focus on protecting the employees of the company and also trying to re-establish the company. However, we believe that benefits should only apply if financial statement information is available. A company should base its decision on whether it's in financial distress on financial information. The only way it can establish that if financial statement is mandatory. Secondly, the bill also proposes offences applicable to preparers of financial statements. So the preparer of a financial statement will be guilty of an offence, either imprisonment or a penalty, if financial statements are prepared which are false or misleading or contain a scheme which makes the financial statement misleading. Now, due to this high reliance that's going to be placed on preparers on financial statements and the offences related thereto, we believe the financial statement should be made mandatory as well as the person that assists the company in preparing those. related submissions with regard to financial statements is that we propose that the definition and scope of accounting records be addressed. I'm just referring again to the appendix section of our submission. It contains proposed amendments to the clauses in the bill so as to give effect to what we propose. The bill does not clearly define or determine what actually accounting records should be, and we made proposals. Then also we ask that financial statements should be linked, or fair presentation should be drafted in the bill as meaning compliance with financial reporting standards. That's the only way that fair presentation has any a meaningful concept. All right, we move on to our second specific proposal that relates to reports on financial statements. What we discussed previously was that all companies, depending on their type, should have a financial statement prepared. We now discuss whether a report should be issued on those financial statements. We request then and like to state that clearly that all companies be required to appoint a report provider on their financial statements. Perhaps a background discussion is necessary. The previous submission was made by the IRBA on the role of registered auditors. We agree with their position that all assurance reports should be regulated by the IRBA. However, it is clear from a reading of our current legislative environment that another report provider is actually requested by those other pieces of statutes. We gave a list of those statutes in our submission. This includes the Schools Act, the Non-Profit Organization Act, the Cooperatives Act, DTI's grant scheme requires the appointment of an accredited person to issue a report, the Close Corporation Act, and a host of others. So it's clear from legislation that the government department, the legislature, recognize the need for a report provider to do a function to report on the financial statement. This has worked well with regard to closed corporations and all those other statutes which we refer to, and we believe that recognition should also be provided within the current company's bill. We wish also to note the differences between an audit, an independent review, and a report of factual findings as proposed by us. The current bill, and with our discussion, we also provided a table for you on page 21, which again conceptualized our proposals. And again, the main assumption on our discussion is that different types of companies proposed within the bill, and therefore different companies require different approaches. It's a moral imperative that the regulation is appropriate for the type of entity that it seeks to regulate, and that results in our proposals here, which was not only differential financial statements, but also ask for differentiated financial report providers. We propose that the independent review, which we consider not necessarily to be an assurance report, it's a report that should be designed, the standard or the framework thereof should be designed as a joint effort between the profession, including the IRBA. And then for owner-managed companies, we propose a similar model as is currently in place for closed corporations with regard to the Cooperatives Act, the Schools Act, the Non-Profit Organizations Act. It's discussed within our submission. And the reason we're asking this is for legislative stability. Other statutes require a non-auditor to report on the financial statements. Therefore, the Companies Act should build on this and establish this stability. Effective financial decision-making requires that the person that of a certain competence be tasked with the duty of preparing financial statements and also assisting the company in ensuring compliance with legislative requirements. And also in this regard, it's important to note that the offences that apply to a preparer of financial statements, and we refer specifically to clause 29(6), which makes it an offence, that's on page 25 of our submission, which makes it an offence for a preparer to prepare financial statements that does not comply with international financial reporting standards. So all preparers guilty of offence if the financial statements they prepare do not comply with international financial reporting standards. This requires a high degree of competence comply with, and also necessitates the need for professional indemnity to protect the company on claims or to enable the company to claim against the preferer. And we would regard, therefore, a framework be established to clearly state what or who should a preferer be. Clause 76.5 entitles the directors of a company to rely on the information provided by an accountant. However, the term accountant is not defined in the bill, so the director is entitled to rely on an accountant, but the person is not defined, nor his standard of conduct. Section 2141D again makes the preparer guilty of an offence, and again the degree of competence is clear that should be applicable to report providers.
I think you'll have to come to your substantive issues.
Yes.
If we are to go the way that you'll have gone, we'll be here listening to you the whole day and tomorrow as well.
Thanks, sir.
Unfortunately, we don't have the time.
All right. I'm going
to have to go to your substantive issues. We have your submission is quite substantial itself. So just summarize your issues. I've already given you 5 more minutes than the allocated time.
Thank you, Chair. We have similar proposals with regard to Financial Reporting Standards Council. We make specific proposals on 2 alternatives. Either the bill should provide for an independent regulator with regard to issuing financial reporting standards, or follow the Canadian model, which just references a voluntary body to issue those accounting standards. Closed corporations, we ask for the future existence of the closed corporation. The difference between private companies, as envisioned in the bill, and closed corporations is the philosophical approach between the two. Although the bill provides for private companies, there's a difference in the governance of those 2 different entities, and we clearly see a need for closed corporations. Then lastly, we ask the DTI to relook the penalty regime. There's some serious clauses that place a serious liability and does not consider materiality, bona fide actions, gross negligence, and intention. We have again provide our model, the specific proposal. It incorporates everything that we've been discussing. And moving on to our general proposals, we wish to just highlight to the DTI and request further consideration of the proposals within our submission, which relates to harmonization with other legislation. The purpose of the bill, very importantly, it'll make the interpretation of the Act very complex. This reckless trading should be linked to causality, which currently it is not. Business rescue provisions, we did discuss those. We request that protection of whistleblowers should be the main reference point in the Act, and the Act would not have a comprehensive discussion of those issues, but just refer to protection of whistleblowers or the protection of the Protected Disclosure Act. That is all our main points, and I'm just going to conclude. Our submission includes an appendix which makes the proposal on amendments to the bill. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just as a general point for other presenters, we do take the time to read your contributions. So, in essence, we know what your aims and objectives are, the various organizations that come in. I know there is the temptation to restate who you are, what you do. It might sound good, but the purpose that we are here for today is to go into the substantive issues. Here's the bill before us. What do you agree with? What don't you agree with? Very strongly with it. Those are the issues that we need to cancel. Members, very briefly, any comments, questions?
Thanks. With regard to penalties, I'm just running my eyes through your document. You seem to be just proposing that the bill recognizing the complex nature of the reporting standards and provide appropriate penalties. Now, obviously there's an implication that those who are
are included as yet and not necessarily approaching. I've been listening also to other presentations, and at times, you know, there's a plea for decriminalization, you know, which to an extent is pleasing for lesser penalties. You know, if you could come up a little bit clearer, I think that what is provided at this stage is poses a risk of being strict and may have adverse effects. So we'd like to have more leniency, if I can use those words. What's appropriate in this sense? That's where I'm at a lot.
Thanks for your chance for a rejoinder.
Thank you. The harshest penalty should apply to clear fraudulent activity and where there was an intention to defraud or do harm. Where that intention isn't there, we should consider gross negligence, bona fide actions, and materiality. And we support the penalty process. We just think it should be made less stringent when there wasn't a clear intention to defraud, and whether the transgression of an accounting, an element of an accounting standard was, which resulted in only a minor technical divergence from the standard, and not make it a require imprisonment for minor actions.
Thank you very much. Good folks. Thank you. As we said to other presenters yesterday, if there's an aspect that we need clarity on, we will contact you for such clarity. Thank you very much. The cheapest watch in the room says it's 20 past. I propose that we have a break for tea, 15 minutes. What do you say? Thank you, Chair. Dr. Ravi, welcome back to the meeting.
Thank you, Chair, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. My name is Ignacio Sovuda, the Executive President of FICA, and with me is Ewald Miller, Technical Director at FICA. First of all, we would like to comment the DTI on this version of the bill. We've been involved with the different versions, and I think there's been a consistent improvement over the different versions. So we will just try and focus, as the Chair requested, on the main issues as we were submitted a detailed comment letter. And just for the record, we the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants supports this Act and the elements that are in it. We believe is a appropriate and proper move to be in the right direction. And the comments that we have that we believe would improve on the Act by no means say that we don't support the Act at all. The first point that we'd like to raise is the section that regards to the Financial Reporting Standards Council's authority with regard to the issuing of standards. At the extent the minister issues the standards, and we would like to ask the committee to look at giving the authority to the Financial Reporting Standards Council to issue the standards, because while it's a technically intensive and time-consuming process to do so, the date of issue and the implementation of the standards are quite key in compliance with the international financial reporting standards. As a country, we have decided many years ago, I think it was in 2005, to harmonize with international financial reporting standards, and we've done so. And that's where all the companies on the JSE are now compliant with international financial reporting standards. Now, if a standard is not issued timely, and it's implemented later than what the international requirement requires, you would find that you then cannot claim to be in compliance with international financial reporting standards. And we do not believe that such an admin issue should be burdened and competing with the time of an important official such as a minister. And I think the Financial Reporting Council can simply do that administrative job in consultation with the minister, as opposed to the other way around, which is now in the Act. And the missing of those kind of deadlines actually would have a dire consequence to the capital market in terms of financial reporting, and will also put the companies listed on the JSE in a difficult situation. And I don't think it's something that we need to be placing the burden on the minister to make him or herself available to enact a standard to be in line with international financial reporting standards. The second point that we'd like to raise is the establishment of the Financial Reporting Investigation Panel, which is not quite clear in the current bill that whether that is a requirement. It's kind of mentioned in passing, but doesn't quite say it could be interpreted either way. And we believe that the Financial Reporting Investigation Panel, as a separate organ, is very important in ensuring that the financial reporting standards that have been issued are being complied with. Currently, some years ago, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, together with the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, or the JSE as it's normally referred to, set up what we call a Gov Monitoring Panel. And the Gov Monitoring Panel is currently doing what we believe the Financial Reporting Investigation Panel will do going forward. And it should be a separate body from the Financial Reporting Council. The Financial Reporting Council will be issuing the standard, and the Investigation Panel will be monitoring and implementing and ensuring that holding people to comply with the standard. So it is quite an important, closely linked but separate function that we believe should be implemented in the Act. The next point that we speak to is with regard to the exemption from preparation of financial statements by a company. And currently, it said that wholly-owned subsidiaries should be excluded together with owner-managed business. And if that clause does say, we don't believe that it should be covering subsidiaries at all. In any situation, for an auditor to issue group financial to issue an audit report on group financial statements, each subsidiary needs to be audited, and as a result, financial statements need to be prepared anyway. So that requirement in the Act will not be in step with what will have to happen in practice, because you cannot audit group financial statements without having audited subsidiaries. So subsidiaries will have to continue to issue financial statements anyway. And I must say, I was listening to the FIFA presentation in terms of owner-managed, and while this might not might extend to owner-managed businesses of being exempt to prepare financial statements, at the very least, any business will have to do tax statements because they've got to render their return. So I'm not too sure in terms of the significance of excluding them, but I think they would have to prepare something anyway. But over and above that, while we talk about these companies keeping accounting records, we do not explain or define in the current bill what the accounting records should constitute. And I believe they should be clearly defined so that when people, for whatever reason, whether maybe the bank requires financial statements or the whatever creditors, their accounting records so defined should be such that they're able then to prepare financial statements. And I think by not giving guidance, the company, more especially at owner-managed level, would be doing them a disservice if 2-3 years down the line they need to prepare financial statements, only to find that they do not have the accounting records necessary or appropriate to draw the financial statement. So even if the committee decides that the exemption should stay, but I think the accounting record should be appropriate to ensure that in terms of need, in case of need, the financial statement can be drawn. The other issue is that of solvency and liquidity tests. And we also believe that those tests, one should not be in terms of assets being equal liabilities, but we believe it should be in a situation where assets should be greater than liabilities as opposed to being equal to. But also, we also believe that when doing the solvency and liquidity test, it should be applied at company level. Because if you have a relationship with a company as a particular entity, let's say, for instance, the relationship is with a group company, and that company itself, the head office, is insolvent, I don't think one would therefore, by definition, have the right to go to a subsidiary, because the legal agreement is with a different company, which is in the group, but insolvent. And therefore, I believe in order to protect people's rights, we need to look at each legal entity within a group, as opposed to assessing the whole group. It often happens, even currently, where you find an insolvent subsidiary which is part of a group. So that is not something that might happen, something that is currently happening as we speak. So I believe it's important for those tests to be done at company level. The other issue that I want to quickly touch on with regard to the definition of in terms of the group, there's a requirement there that in a subsidiary you have to have at least one outside shareholder or one natural person as a shareholder. Now, I'm not too sure what the objective there is, but again, currently as we speak, there's hundreds of companies in groups which are wholly owned by the groups, and there is no outside shareholder. Now, clearly, for this outside shareholder issue to be introduced, there must have been an objective that needed to be satisfied by that, and would like to understand more so as we can help achieve that objective, because by saying that there must be one other shareholder, I believe we're going to recover in the marketplace, because each company now must find one shareholder to issue a share to all the subsidiaries to ensure that they comply. But obviously, I believe it has been put in here for a reason, and would like to find out more as to what that reason is, and we're quite happy to assist in making sure that those objectives are complied with or are reached without having to turn the marketplace upside down. The other issue is, it's said in there that the board, the shareholder should appoint an audit committee. Now, there are several problems with that requirement. Firstly, in South Africa, both in the private sector and the public sector, on state-owned entities, we work with the concept of a unitary board, where the board takes responsibility of corporate and other issues, of governance issues that happen within an organization. Therefore, if you now ask the shareholders to be appointing the audit committee, now the audit committee becomes a separate appointed organ within the board that now is responsible to the shareholders, who now then takes the responsibility of the financial statements. Because currently, and we suggest that going forward, the board of directors should carry the responsibility of the financial statements of the company. And therefore, because they are responsible for the overall financial statements, they need to be the ones appointing the audit committee. Because together, as a board, they take responsibility, not the audit committee alone. And there's different types of boards, like in Germany where you've got a supervisory board and what, and even the Germans will tell you that their system is actually not working and they're finding it difficult to move to what the other countries are doing. So I don't believe we should at this stage be introducing something that takes away from the unitary board system that we actually have in South Africa, unless one day the country, for whatever reason, we decide that we need a different type of board. But currently, the whole board takes the full responsibility of what happens in an organization, including the financial statements that we present to the shareholder. And good practice these days require that when you go to the shareholders' meeting, not only the chair of the audit committee, the chair of the risk committee, the chair of the remuneration committee, the nominating committee, if they have, must go to the shareholders to account to the shareholders on their activities. But that does not mean that the shareholders should now appoint the audit committee. The last point that we'd like to make is there's a whole lot of areas that would be governed by regulation, including which companies would be audited. There'll be regulations that determine that, and you know, the setting up of this FRC and all the other organs. And experience suggests that the Act is better implemented if all these regulations are issued up front, and all transition provisions also published up front. That enables the smooth enactment and the smooth functioning of the Act when it comes into place. If we implement the Act and the regulations and the other things that go with it are not yet hammered out and published, it makes life difficult for the implementation of the Act itself. So we strongly suggest that all the regulations that go together with the Act be drafted and published before the actual implementation of the Act. Chairperson, we have other secondary comments that are in our comment letter. We will not go on that in the interest of time. But we really once more, all these things that we have mentioned, we believe are an improvement on an already good document, and we commend the CTI for the work. Thank you. We'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. Members, any comments, questions? We have been at this for several days, and the cardinal issues are the same. It should also be very clear to the department where it will labor most. The same issues I have, as members have asked the same question. So, thank you very much. Board. We are in your able hands. Unfortunately, you will not have the opportunity to go through those three Bibles you have brought. You may commence as soon as you are ready.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to present this submission before you. It was certainly not an intention to go through this Bible, and Mr. Chairman, we understand you've been at this thing for a long time. Our approach to this submission is to play a positive role in order to help you to achieve the best possible legislation for what is vital part of the modern world, namely the commercial sector. Mr. Chairman, you understand the importance of this bill and your role in this process to help making sure that it succeeds. The APB, without belaboring the point, is the current standard setter for financial reporting. We have been doing this since 1973, that is over 35 years, and we are an independently constituted body consisting of several members, and I'll be short, Mr. Chairman, you have warned us, but I think it's important to distinguish ourselves to the other presenters here. We represent the Accounting Standard Board covering the government sector. We also represent professional bodies, accounting and management fields. We also represent academic specialist fields like banking and mining. Mr. Chairman, we also represent the stock exchange and regulators such as EBA. So in short, we represent the business community. And it is in this capacity that our submission covers sections of the bill which relate to financial reporting. And Mr. Chairman, firstly, like the previous speaker, I would like to commend the DTI and the team for this bill, because in our view, it does meet the objects that are set in the memorandum of the bill. There are two important amendments that, in our opinion, need to be considered, Mr. Chairman, in order to make sure that the financial reporting of this bill succeeds and meets the intended objectives. We would like to go through some of those points, and to, for ease of reference, Mr. Chairman, we'll just refer you to our pages. There's a detail that we enclose in this submission, but we are not going to cover that. We understand you have read it and we respect it. But there are four or five or close to, you know, few issues that we would like to highlight, but we would like to focus the members on those specific pages that we can discuss them fully. But also, we are happy to assist in whatever form, even after this submission, we would like to continue to have interaction with the DGI and this committee also in making sure that you can clarify our point. I'll ask one of my colleagues, Charles Hoku, also the member of the APB, to take us further with the process. We also have Sue Ludov, whom I haven't introduced, who is the technical director in the Secretariat of the Accounting Practice Board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my chairman, Mr. Fasana. May I just make clear, do the members of the committee all have a copy of our submission? Because I'm going to refer to one page specifically. Can I just see a show of hands? Do not have copies?
No, we don't.
All right, thank you.
The members have got copies.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to refer you on page 1 to section 2, and it refers to the aspect of a related person. The bill at the moment refers to the third degree of consanguinity or affinity. Now, for a non-English speaker like me, I'm actually struggling even with the word consanguinity, but eventually we understood that eventually you were talking about a cousin, for example. And if I may ask you to go to the very last page of our submission, please, we have an example there that I'd like to run through with you. The very last page, it says appendix in terms of comment on subsection 2, subsection 1. Now, Mr. Chairman, what we have there is a short list of natural persons who are related, who have either a significant interest in the company or a very small interest in the company. And you will see that this list of persons are related, no argument about that. But because of the way that the Act then refers to control, adding 24% to another 24%, and then adding a 2.5% that happens to be in the same kind of relationship gives you control over a company that has got nothing to do with, in this case, company X. The fact is that the law then makes companies X and Y related, and the result is, inter alia, that one company cannot trade with the other company unless the trade agreement is approved by ordinary resolution in terms of section 753, and in another case the directors cannot even buy clothes without determining that there is a solvent situation. We don't think that that was the intention of the bill, and we submit that this aspect should be redefined in the way that we've been handling it for many years, and which has actually brought out related parties quite well. The second point I'd like to take you to is page 3 of our submission, and it refers to section 28 and the accounting records in terms of their appropriateness. We've heard in other submissions, certainly today, that the importance of records in being able to manage the affairs of the company is very, very strong. It is an extremely important aspect. It is even more important if there is later action to be taken against the directors or the company itself, because it is the accounting records that will prove whether there have been inappropriate dealings or, in fact, inappropriate relationships entered into, even at a specific point when there was insolvency and so forth. So we are suggesting that a very good set of requirements in the current legislation be introduced into the bill. My third point is on page 4, under subsection 29, and I need to just be very clear that we're all on the same line, because there are a number of references to subsection 29. The portion I'd like to refer to start off by saying, subsections 29 1A and B require. And I just check everybody happy that we're on the same. This aspect is about the financial reporting standards, form and content, and present fairly. Now, you must realize, as my chairman has indicated to your chairman, that we live in the real world where there is arguments about standards and whether they've been correctly applied. And we know what the response is of entities who do not wish to apply these standards in the way that they should be applied. They argue that the standards themselves are somehow wrong, and that fair presentation means you can ignore them. Of course, I'm exaggerating somewhat, but that effectively is what happens at the monitoring stage. We are saying that wording that says that the statement should present fairly the state of affairs and business of the company in terms of financial reporting standards gives us that fixed point from where one can then go into logical and hopefully consultative argument as to whether financial reporting standards were perhaps not fair. So that strengthens the arm eventually of the regulator. I pass to my chairman again.
Chairman, one of the important points that I mentioned earlier is on our page 5, it's again section 29, section 29.4. And I can emphasize here that the previous speaker also referred to this point, Chairman. But from the current standard status, we've got experience in dealing with these things, and we have been aware as to what is the process that we go through in approving this process. And if you look at the section 29.4, Chairman, it says that the minister, after consulting the council, may make regulation prescribing financial reporting standards complemented in this part. Subsection 203 gives the minister the power to establish the council and select and approve appropriate qualified members to the council, which we agree with. The development and management of financial reporting standards require extremely high level of technical accounting knowledge and fast reaction to developing trends. Financial reporting standards are complex, Mr. Chairman, and have extensive financial and economic impact. It is appropriate, in our view, for the council to be given the authority to manage the entire process of researching, developing, and issuing financial reporting standards. Section 204 will still cater for the council to advise the minister on matters relating to financial reporting. This is our proposal, Mr. Chairman, that this section be amended to state that the council shall make regulation prescribing financial reporting standards contemplated in this part. And having worked on this thing, we think that will actually help in fast-tracking and making sure that there's no delay in in approving financial report. If you go again on the next page, Mr. Chairman, page 6 of our submission, on top there, subsection 29, 4 and 5, it also refers to financial reporting standards. And the definition of financial reporting standards referred to this section. It needs to state that financial reporting standards include interpretation of financial reporting standards issued by the council for specific local issues. And our proposal, as stated there, is that the subsection be amended to say the financial reporting standards include South African interpretation of financial reporting standards. This can be done by inserting an interpretation of this financial reporting standards issued by the council after the body.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman, we are talking about financial reporting standards, and just in reference to the previous speaker, remember that our BEE transactions, for example, are not as well understood in the rest of the world, and it's crucial that we have clarity on that as well in our country. I'm referring on the same page to the section 30, subsection 31, refers to prepare annual financial statements, but not to prepare and publish. As somebody who has been involved in the kind of problems that occur in companies, I can assure you that one of the most important things is that there's a clear line made as to what financial statements finally are the financial statements of a company. And if you're simply preparing, you can have 7 versions and nobody actually says, this is the set that was published, this is the set that was final. And when we wish to make this new act something which can be monitored well, this is very important. The word publish does not mean to the public. There are cases, of course, where one does publish to the public, but private companies would not be publishing to the public. Publish is a technical legal word, and we're simply saying that there needs to be clarity as to which were the final financial statements. I then go to page 8, where we talk about subsection 35.3b, if you are with me on that page, must at least have one share issued to at least one person other than the company. We've heard the comments on this before. Let me point out some technical facts that perhaps don't come fresh to mind. A company may have only 10 shares. If one of the shares is to be held by another person, it means 10% of the share capital is held by another person. All of this company, the concept of companies having millions of shares, but many actually only have 10 or maybe 100. And it is important and critical for shareholder support, which often is required, for example, like our banking ledger, the banking regulator. It's critical for shareholder support that they will support if they are wholly owning. If you're not wholly owning a company, the tendency is to hold back when support is required and say, why should I be supporting something where an external shareholder is involved? Plus, there's often a contractual requirement to notify, for example, the landlord of these premises if your shareholding changes. And that landlord has the option of canceling the lease or amending the lease. If this clause remains here, we would have serious ramifications in many cases where people haven't necessarily seen that as a possibility. I refer there again to my chairman.
Chairman, this is our last point of emphasis. As mentioned by the previous speaker from SAICA, if you look at section 183.3, that is on page 9 of our submission, this refers only in passing to the function of what was termed the Financial Reporting Investigating Panel in the Corporate Law Amendment Act. It's our opinion, Mr. Chairman, that the monitoring of financial standards and the issuing thereof should actually be separate. And also, if you look on the page, the following page 10, subsection 183.3 and 204, it is unclear what is required of the council with respect to compliance with financial reporting standards. The council must be responsible for setting financial reporting standards and not monitoring compliance with those standards too. I think this point was emphasized clearly by the previous speaker, and we just want to emphasize it again here, Mr. Chairman, for clarity. That there are many other points that we said which we are not going to cover, but at this stage, in the interest of time also, we'd like again to commend the DGI and say we in general support the bill, and those are just some of the points that we believe as current standard status we'd like to bring to the attention of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Members, comments, questions? Thank you, good folks. We do have your presentation. All I've said previous presenters apply to me. Let me need you, we'll call you. And the presentation is marked X, expression X. We are in your ambulance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to first introduce myself. My name is Melissa Moore from the Freedom of Expression Institute. And we would like to thank the Portfolio Committee for allowing us to make this submission. It should be noted that we are merely going to summarize our submission, as I'm sure all the presenters before me have touched on all these issues before. We're also going to confine ourselves to our mandate, which is freedom of expression issues. Just as a brief introduction, ISICSA was established in 1994 to protect and foster the right to freedom of expression and access to information, and to oppose censorship. The ISICSA's primary objectives are to fight for and defend freedom of expression, to oppose censorship, and to fight for the right of equal access to information and knowledge, and to promote access to the media and the free press. The ISICSA undertakes a wide variety of activities in support of these objectives, and it is in this light that we have prepared this submission for you. We would like to state at the outset that we are in agreement that the current Companies Act is in need of review and updating in line with the rapidly evolving business climate, which the electronic age has facilitated. To that extent, a large number of changes are required to meet the needs of this rapidly changing society in the post-apartheid era. We also subscribe to the necessity of change. Our concerns will be demonstrated below, as will be demonstrated below, are largely to do with the honouring of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa and the right to freedom of expression, contained in Section 16 of the Constitution, as well as Section 32, the right of access to information. The principles espoused in the Constitution must be reflected in all legislation, and to this end it is vital that the bill should advance both the spirit and the letter of the Constitution. It is particularly important that in a time of economic turmoil and investor uncertainty that due and proper consideration is given to measures that will both enhance economic performance and bolster investor confidence. As such, the bill has a vital role to play in allaying the fears of investors and providing a proper framework for economic upliftment. At the core of this is the preeminent requirement that all transactions be conducted in a transparent and honest fashion. It is essential that companies recognize their obligations to the public, and to that end, that sufficient measures are put in place to ensure the sanctity of investor rights. If we can proceed to the objects of the bill, the ISICSA is fully supportive of the objectives set out in the bill, specific reference to Section 5, Register Section 7, which provides that the bill must be interpreted and applied in a manner that gives effect to the purpose of the bill, which includes the promotion of the development of the South African economy by encouraging transparency and high standards of corporate governance, given in this, given the significant role of enterprises within the social and economic life of the nation, and to balance the rights and obligations of shareholders and directors within companies. The acknowledgement of the primacy of the provisions of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, PIA, are incredibly honourable. But if we then move to the transparency, freedom of expression and access to information, there are a couple of issues which I will deal with a little bit later, which I think need to be addressed in the bill. Section 15 of the Constitution guarantees everyone the right to freedom of expression, freedom of the media and press, and freedom to impart information and ideas. The Constitutional Court has articulated the importance of the right of the public to receive information and the role which the media plays in being the conduit through which the public receives such information. I'll have set out in our submission a couple of court cases where the Constitutional Court has actually gone and set out these rights and explained them, but I would just like to quote from one of them, which is the South African National Defence Union Minister of Defence and others, where the Constitutional Court said that freedom of expression lies at the heart of democracy. It is valuable for many reasons, including its instrumental function as a guarantor of democracy, its implicit recognition and protection of the moral agency of individuals in our society, and its facilitation of the search for truth by individuals and society generally. I think that is the most apt in the circumstances. The importance of public interest cannot be overstated, and it is the role of the media to convey information which allows matters of public interest to be fully scrutinized by the public at large. Public interest itself dictates that information which is of importance to all players in the economy be disseminated as widely as possible. The distinction which is drawn between irresponsible publication and the publication of matters which are truthful and in the public interest should be the guideline for determining the rights of the media to publish information which would otherwise be in the private domain. South Africa has a well-developed law of defamation and which affords relief to offended persons, and this is exactly what would should be used to delimit the bounds of information which needs to be placed before the public. The balance between what should be protected as private information must be addressed, as dictated by Section 36, which outlines the balancing of conflicting rights. Ideally, any restriction on information being published must pass the Section 36 constitutional test. In terms of Section 32, which is the section dealing with access to information, everyone has the right to access of information. And that also includes any information held by the state, but also any information that is held by another person and that is required for the protection of any rights. The Promotion of Access to Information Act was promulgated to give effect to the Section 32 constitutional rights, and what is very important here is the preamble of PIA, which provides that PIA has been enacted inter alia to foster a culture of transparency and accountability in public and private bodies by giving effect to the right of access to information and actively promote a society in which the people of South Africa have effective access to information and enable them to more fully exercise and protect their rights. In terms of PIA, a requester must be given access to a record if the procedural requirements of PIA are complied with, and the access to the record is not refused in terms of the ground set out in PIA for refusal. So this establishes a presumption of the right of access to information held by both public and private bodies. Furthermore, PIA is not exhaustive of the right to access to information. We do believe that Section 32 can also be used to acquire access. And the rights of freedom of expression and access to information are, as I said, not without limits. Any limitation must, however, be justifiable in terms of Section 36. Now, it is with these principles in mind that we have addressed certain other problems that we have with the bill. The first one being the whistleblower rights and the extension thereof in, you know, support of corporate governance. Now, the FXI has engaged with the Open Democracy Centre on this specific issue, and there is general consensus of the issues that are to be raised, except otherwise stated in this oral submission. In respect of Section 1593A, it is welcome that there's a long list of people and organisations that can receive disclosure or receive information, but we are of the view that this section should not contain an exhaustive list of persons to whom disclosures can be made. The provision should at least be amended to include trade unions and professional bodies and the media. Now, the inclusion of the media is the view of the FXI in order to maintain good governance, and it's closely linked with that principle. For ordinary individuals, some of the individuals mentioned, or the people to whom disclosure can be made, and organisations, may seem too remote. So the inclusion of trade unions and professional bodies would serve the purpose of creating the potential for disclosure to bodies which are a step removed from the company. They are also most likely to be informed about the contravention of their by members. We would like to see the inclusion of trade unions and professional associations in this section, given the range of potential whistleblowers concerned. The inclusion of the media would be a true acknowledgement of individual liberty, as well as an affirmation of the right to freedom of expression. In respect of Section 1593B, the words reasonably believed should be replaced by reasonable grounds to suspect. The test of reasonable grounds to suspect is less onerous than reasonably believed. The reasonable belief sets the threshold for protection too high. The term reasonable grounds to suspect has enjoyed considerable attention by our court, and in this regard I refer you to the Van Heeren case, where it was stated that these words must be interpreted objectively and the grounds of suspicion must be those which would induce a reasonable man to have suspicion. The reasonable suspicion test provides more protection for the whistleblower than the requirement of a belief reasonably held. A reasonable suspicion, however, involves certainty of truth. From its very nature, reasonable suspicion cannot result in a definite and unequivocal state of mind which excludes any other possible answer. There is also another case that I would like to refer you to, which is also cited in the submission, in paragraph 25. The bill should then also provide sufficient protection for the identity of whistleblowers. Although Section 1597A does include the word confidentiality, the bill should still include a clause which states that the recipient of the disclosure of the information must protect the identity of the whistleblower unless he has obtained the consent of the whistleblower to make known his identity. We are also of the view that the court should be able to give interdictory relief if they are satisfied that a person has taken or intends to take detrimental action against a whistleblower. Our next concern relates to Section 212, which states that when submitting information to the Commission, the panel, the company's ombud, the council, or an inspector or investigator appointed in terms of this Act, a person may claim that all or part of the information is confidential. Now, the problem that we have with this clause is that it creates a lot of uncertainty with regard to what constitutes confidential information, as there's no definition of what constitutes confidential information, nor are there any guidelines or considerations that have to be taken into account when determining when information is confidential. And this authority is left in the discretion of the people that I mentioned about before, which is the counsel or the ombud or the investigator. So I think this specific section has to be strongly defined and redrafted. Then, with regards to access to company records, while Section 26 protects the rights of shareholders and makes it clear that such people are entitled to obtain copies of the relevant information, it does not affirm the rights of investigative journalists and the public, which we believe is a serious omission. It is our belief that in order to promote the freedom of the media and to generally advance the cause of good governance, it is desirable to include a provision which specifically states that such rights exist. The inclusion of such a provision would then improve access to information and be in line with the Bill's professed objective. So that concludes the concerns that we have about the Bill. And we would like to thank you for allowing us to make these submissions to you and reiterate that we are more than willing to engage in discussions, and should you require our further assistance, we offer it to you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Moore. Members, Dr. Njigala. I'm looking at Section 169, 38, as Mr. Zanda stated, that she would like to make a decision or see a decision, the inclusion of trade unions, professional bodies, and the media to maintain good governance. Obviously, that would be helpful if you could facilitate a little bit. Because I'm also looking at the list of people or institutions where we should loan or disclosure of information can be made. And my understanding that there's a purpose to have that definite list of people, because at the end of the day, it appears to me this is where, if information is disclosed, there could be immediate, but there could be action for ensuring good governance. Now, the question I have is, to what extent, or in what way, can trade union professional bodies in the media now ensure good governance within a company about information disclosed? Unless I'm missing something somewhere. Because amongst other things, the purpose of this legislation is to ensure good governance in a company. The other one is the confidential information. There is no definition of what would constitute confidential information. Would you small perhaps have any suggestion of what would be constituting confidential information in the context of this case? Lastly, with regard to access to company records, a specific reference is made to investigative journalists, not just journalists, but investigative journalists. I thought journalists, including investigating journalists, were part of the public. Is there any reason of specifying them? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ali. Thank you, Chairman. You mentioned access to confidential information, but yesterday in a number of submissions it was mentioned that quite a number of companies, whether it's private or public companies, have got a certain business status, they've got marketing status and so forth, which allows them to have a competitive advantage among many of these others. How do you distinguish between confidential information regarding marketing, regarding to help you to attain your market share or to increase your market share? Do you think it's fair to force these particular companies to disclose their particular competitive advantage or their strategy? I'd just like to have your view there, because this is an ethical question. And I think it's been debated in quite a number of circles. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, members. Ms. Moore, your rejoinder, please.
Thank you for the question. If I can, I will deal with them in order that they were raised. The role of trade unions in a good governance, I think it's more of a overarching role that they play in being the voice of the employees concerned. So in that regard, good governance is promoted if trade unions are included in the list of people to whom disclosures can be made, because it would make it easier for employees to address their trade unions on these issues, so that the overall good governance is protected of the company. Does that answer that question for you?
Through Chair, that may be a point, but that may be a point with regards to trade unions. But professional board is the media, through the structures that are outside. And if you look at the list of people here, as without stronger than Kane, one way or another, they are linked to some form of assurance for good governance within a company. The list doesn't exist. Now, I'm grappling to understand the extent which professional bodies and the media could do that, except that media, obviously, for them to increase the circulation of the paper.
I think in that regard, what we must remember is the overarching right of all employees and all citizens of this company to speak and to express themselves, regardless of the provisions of this Act. That might be a bold statement, but I'll explain why I'm saying it. They do have the right to address the media on issues of public importance. And I stress public importance and public interest because it is closely related to what was raised regarding the confidentiality clause. I think that employees should be able to address the media, and it should be included in this bill so that that right is, in fact, acknowledged. Now, obviously, an employee can't address the media without good grounds, or any of these bodies, or any of these persons, without good grounds and without good information. That's why I'm saying that there are other remedies that are in place for breach of that. And professional bodies, I think they also play a similar role to trade unions in this regard. If I can then deal with the question that was raised regarding the confidential information, it goes without saying that there is information that needs to be protected. There are justifiable limitations on access to information, and I think the example that you raised would fall under that. But as I said, the determining factor is when it would be in the public interest to disclose such information, for instance, corruption or money laundering or insider trading, things like that. Then you should not be able to rely on the confidential provision in the Act or in the bill. What is confidential information? I think that that is a question that we are all really trying to determine, specifically with regard to other bills that are going to Parliament at the moment, like the Protection of Information Bill. If the committee would like me to, I can attempt to draft one for you and circulate it, and maybe that could assist you in some way. The distinction between investigative journalists and normal journalists and the public, it is true, they are members of the public, but I think the inclusion of the word investigating or investigative journalists was merely to highlight their investigative role and the role that the media plays as the conduit through which the public receives their information. So in that regard, you can take it as them all being the same.
Thank you very much. The other matters, Sita, you will discuss over lunch. Thank you.
Just a small thing, Chair.
No. Okay. Those small things, they become big. This is why they discuss it over lunch. I'm sure Ms. Moore would appreciate your voice over lunch. Thank you very much, Ms. Moore. Good folks. Banking Association of South Africa. Nedbank, if you are serious about money, EFSA today, tomorrow. Standard Bank.
First National, how can we help you?
First National, how can we help you? And they listen to you when you deposit money. The day you don't have money, you get that call. Is there any reason why we should keep this account of yours open? Do you know what balance you have in your account? And you wonder, but this is my account, I should know. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see I've been on your screen for the last half an hour. Mr. Chairman, I was very shortly before lunch. Thank you for the opportunity to address you. There is a written submission, and I won't highlight the 32 pages of points. Other than to comment that the first draft comment was 8 pages, so obviously we appreciate the effort that went into the second draft. Mr. Chairman, I think we have a major concern with the time that was allowed to prepare comments on the bill, and I'm sure other parties have made the same comment. It's been very difficult to analyze the bill, 220 odd pages, to prepare comments for our constituency in the banking sector in particular has had difficulty in meeting the time deadline because it has impact on the institutions themselves, it has impact on their accounting processes, it has impact on their clients, it has impact on the products that they provide to their clients, and then obviously the international investment and merchant banking, as well as business rescue. And business rescue is a significant feature of the bill. So we would plead with the committee and with the department that this is a whole act rewrite. The fire is not burning, the act is functioning, the existing companies act, and that one would need time to consider carefully some of the requirements and some of the implementation difficulties that we and others will raise. The practical challenge, Mr. Chairman, and we know this from other legislation, is once this bill is passed, it takes 3 to 5 years before the department and the parliamentary process comes back to reconsider changes. The parliamentary program is just too full to start amending a bill that was passed last year. And we have this experience with the National Credit Act, where the regulators now turning to the courts to give declaratory orders because of the differences of interpretation of some of the sections. So we would suggest that we need to have additional time to consider this. The bridges are not burning. Mr. Chairman, I would like to highlight some specific features, mainly from the perspective of the banking industry. A couple of general comments. One is we accept the proposal to use this bill for small companies, and that the CC registration will be closed. The challenge, however, is for any small company to know what their legal and legislative framework is, they have to read the whole bill. and 200 pages of reading for an entrepreneur, I think, is ideal. The CC Act is something like 30, 35 pages. It's understandable. 200 pages of company build is just too much for a small company entrepreneur. I think an issue throughout the build is the use of the term company ombud. An ombud, by definition, is a free service for adjudicating disputes between consumers and suppliers or service providers. The ombud in this bill is more of an appeal tribunal or an administrative tribunal. It is given power to implement fines, change notices, and do any other things that an appeal tribunal would do, not an ombud. This is a general request. Maybe we need to consider the concept of ombud versus the appeal tribunal. Mr. Chairman, specifically business rescue, this is of importance to the banking industry, and we would raise concerns around the supervisor. The supervisor is the key to the process, and we accept that. The challenge is we don't know who these people are. The bill provides that they must be professionals in a legislated framework. The bill currently provides for one such association to be designated. But we actually don't know who these people are. We don't know where they are. We don't know how many they are. We don't know how they will function. Is it a single appointment? Because we must remember they are line managers. They're going to go in. They're not consultants. They will actually manage the company. That will be a full-time occupation. We're not sure how long they'll be appointed for. We don't understand how they will actually exist from one appointment to the next. Are they going to stand around like consultants, or like hospital ambulance chasing lawyers outside the ambulance hospitals waiting for somebody to appoint them? Are they going to be consultants who may be consultants one day and supervisors the next? But effectively, how they run their lives and their businesses seems to us to be a challenge, because their appointments can vary from 3 weeks, where the business rescue is not viable, to probably a year or more, where they have to manage a company out of distress. I would think it's very difficult for any person to manage and plan a life, occupation under those conditions. But they are key to the process, and we would obviously require some clarity on that. We have a serious challenge, Mr. Chairman, with the enabling in the bill for the supervisor to cancel, suspend, or amend any contracts or terms of a contract. Banks in particular rely on the sanctity of contract for their security. Whether it's a mortgage loan, other security, a guarantee, a suretyship, and the ability of any outsider to come in and terminate any of those conditions would put the entire law of contracts in doubt. In banks' case, that could put their entire security that they hold in doubt. That has implications under the Basel II, under the supervisory framework, that may require them to hold additional provisions for those debts, or may require them to hold additional capital, simply because of the insecurity related to the law of contract. And for us, that is a significant challenge and a cost. And we seriously recommend that the provisions allowing the supervisor to review, to suspend, or to terminate conditions be reviewed, because it introduces add-on consequences specifically for the banking industry, which may not be so relevant in other creditor sectors. The same could be argued about subsections 35A and B of the Insolvency Act. They are referred to in the bill, probably at the instigation of the banking sector in previous discussions. But there are some questions about the interpretation of this and the impact of this. And it is possible, there are some views that this may implement a deeming clause, so that if this were to be applied, it could be deemed in a different interpretation that the Insolvency Act now kicks in, which is not the intention of the bill. So we just have a question around that. Finally, in business rescue, the preferences for post-commencement finance, they are dealt with to some extent in the bill, that they refer to almost a date and a time, and that the date and the time sequencing would determine the preferences of the post-commencement finance, but it's not clear how transparent those conditions would be, or what would happen if a financier was not aware that there was another financier in the queue ahead of him or her. And also it refers to, there is a provision that post-commencement finance can take security to the extent that security is not already pledged. Then it refers to all unsecured creditors will rank the same. It's unclear whether this is unsecured post-finance or including unsecured pre-finance. So the question of preferences in the post-commencement phase would need to be clarified. The bill, Mr. Chairman, is a definition for securities, and it refers to the Securities Services Act. The challenge we have is that the words, the term securities and shares are used interchangeably and sometimes indiscriminately in the Act. And we would really request the drafters to analyse each clause where the words shares or securities are used to ensure that they use the right concept, because they're not the same. The term securities, and we've given it we've repeated the definition in our submission, they are not the same, that could result in confused interpretation. Mr. Chairman, the issue of the statutory provision in the bill versus the International Financial Reporting Standards has been referred to. It will cause confusion if there are different valuation models presented. The definition of a subsidiary is different. There's a concept of 50% plus one, or there's a concept of control, which is relevant. The issue of one outside shareholder has been raised. We would obviously share the concern. And then in some contexts, there are different definitions between the bill and the IRS in relation to shares and debt instruments. And we really plead that this needs to be aligned, probably more reference to alignment with the IFRS, which is our national tendency as well. Solvency and liquidity tests, we understand the need for them. Again, the practical implementation. Is this a once-off picture, once a month, once every 3 months, once every 6 months, once a year? Some incidents that trigger that, we're not sure. There's reference to trading recklessly, which is almost a continuous concept, but we would require clarity on how the solvency and liquidity tests would be applied in the context of time. There's reference to different valuation models, there's different definitions of assets and liabilities. Does it refer to contingent liabilities, goodwill, the intangible assets in a company? All of these can complicate the application of this and would require clarity. Again, something that might be dealt with in the regulations. Also not clear how this will be made transparent to stakeholders other than the company. The company can request to go into business rescue. Other stakeholders would have to go to court. But it's not clear how they would know if the company is failing the insolvency or liquidity test. Chairman, strict liability. The bill in a number of cases implies or refers to strict liability. If you do this, you are guilty. As opposed to if you do this with willful intent or deliberately or with gross negligence. And we would request that the issue of strict liability is carefully considered and in fact taken out of the bill. The same with the law of dealings and damages. In a couple of clauses, the bill provides for damages. We would argue that there is enough provision in the common law, and it is a statutory minefield if the regulator and legislator want to go into the field of damages in the statute, and we'd request that those would also be deleted. There's a new regime for name reservation. The challenge we have, Mr. Chairman, is defensive name reservation. Currently, you can register names defensively to protect them for your use. A simple question is translation. You are entitled to register one name, and that will be the trading name of the company. What about translations into the other 10 or 11 official languages? Would these be automatically reserved, or can you, in fact, you can't reserve them defensively? So the question would be whether we still need to reconsider the issue of defensive name reservation for companies. I'm sure that a number of people have commented on the registration of external companies. There's a list of 8 types of business. And it says if you do all or more of the following, all or more must be an error. But the listed activities themselves seem to be a very narrow definition and could have some unintended consequences. Record keeping, bill makes provision for 7 years, a number of other pieces of legislation for 5. We would argue for 5 years. 2 years of extra record keeping is a significant paper warehousing cost, Mr. Chairman. One of my crosses in life, Mr. Chairman, is that I represent FICA in our industry. The challenge with FICA and the Companies Bill is the term beneficial interest. The Companies Bill requires one level of shareholding up, or a second level where there's a nominee. The challenge that the banks face, under guidance from the FIC and the Register of Banks, is they have to comply with international best practice and international standards. So although our law doesn't require it, their guidance and supervisory model does. And they are required to become forensic auditors. They have to pierce the corporate veil until they find a shareholder who bleeds when you scratch a person, an individual. But the support requirements, the JSC listing rules, the corporate registration in the Companies Commission only require one level of shareholding. So we have a dissonance between the required disclosure, one level of shareholding, and the de facto disclosure, which is pierce the corporate veil. And we would really request that there should be some forcing of the companies to declare who are the ultimate beneficial shareholders, i.e. persons. Because de facto, that's what we are required to do. The shareholder activism, the bill provides for increased shareholder activism, and we understand the need for that, but one also needs to consider the abuse of the process. There are, and we have many examples where there are vexatious one-share shareholders. Specifically in the banking industry, ex-clients who feel aggrieved because they think their bank has done them badly, they buy one share, and then they become very obnoxious, vexatious shareholders, and they totally disrupt shareholder meetings. That has a negative impact on corporate governance, and we'd argue that in the concept of promoting shareholder activism, the positive, we also need to consider the negative where the process gets abused. And we have made some recommendations around that. Chairman Directives, the bill makes provision for deeming certain officials who are members of a board committee as directors. We would argue that this is an unfair practice. It will impact on the functioning of certain bank processes where, for argument's sake, the head of risk, the head of credit, would be a member of the board credit committee. They would then be deemed as directors with all the liabilities that go with their deeming, whereas they are not in fact appointed or approved directors. And we would suggest that that is a concept which needs to be excised from the bill. The bill makes provision that in a private company, not state-owned enterprises, 50% at least of the directors must be elected. In our current dispensation, all directors need to be elected and approved by the shareholders, and we would argue that that needs to be retained. The 50% may apply to state-owned enterprises, but this particular section is not relevant, where the minister would appoint a certain number of directors. And then there must also be a provision for the board to fill vacancies and between general meetings, and then the next general meeting would either confirm those appointments or the directors would have to resign. A small point, Mr. Chairman, it makes provision for juristic persons or partnerships to be appointed the company secretary. Again, we support that. The challenge is a practical implementation burden. It requires that all employees or all partners and employees must be vetted. Somebody like PricewaterhouseCoopers, that might be 130 partners, only one or two of which would have any direct connection with the company. So the question would be, you should only vet those that are dealing with the company itself. Again, that's a bigger problem that we experience. Finally, Mr. Chairman, repeat, the existing regime is not falling down, it's not burning. We have time to consider the practical implementation of this bill. The challenge we have is that any mistakes we don't catch now, it will take anything between 3 and 5 years to repair, simply because the parliamentary process is too busy to go and update a recently passed piece of legislation. And that is problematic. It requires challenges in implementing, and it requires alternative measures to be put in place. So we would really, really request that we consider that. consider it more carefully. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Members, comments, questions?
The company ombud, the third company tribunal. Is there no shifting the company ombud to a tribunal? Is there no risk that maybe shifting closer to the commission function or other bodies for that matter? I think generally I take the point here, I'm sure, when we address ourselves and look into them, particularly the concerns around business rescue. But these are just my little query around the company ombud versus a tribunal body.
Thank you. Mr. Lavascasini, followed by Dr. Rand. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. That curiosity on Section 664B, you know, 50% of the directors to be elected. I mean, if, say, you have a board which needs an expert in a certain field, the board decides to invite somebody to join the board. Now, as you say, that shouldn't be allowed. Should there be a special shareholders meeting then to cover that? Might take place for an AGM or something. Is this such a big deal? I'm just curious. Thank you.
Dr. Rabbit? Chairman, my question related to winding up the companies, the sovereign companies. Sovereign companies. You mentioned the role of the supervisor. Now, seen in the light that there is skill shortage in this country, do you think that we have adequate resources to appoint enough supervisors to wind up these insolvent companies? I think it's very, some of these people are often fairly busy. I don't know how many companies go insolvent, but I assume with our present high interest rates, it will be quite a common factor. Now, we had a discussion earlier this morning. You mentioned the fact that credit controllers, there's a dire shortage of credit controllers. Now, wouldn't these three repeat themselves here when it comes to the winding up of insolvent companies to get adequate supervisors to wind up the business? I'd just like to have your views on that. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Your chance for a rejoin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The issue that the ombud versus the tribunal, if one looks at all the various duties and the specific sections in the bill that refer to the role and function of the ombud, very few of them actually relate to a consumer or the complaint about the company. It's administratively, for argument's sake, where a compliance notice has been issued, you can appeal to the ombud. The ombud is entitled to change your articles of association or memorandum of incorporation. The ombud is allowed to do certain administrative penalties. None of those are actually in the role of a traditional ombudsman. An ombudsman as defined as a consumer-friendly, consumer-focused alternative dispute resolution. So the only real question we're asking is that the term ombudsman is probably incorrect and should more appropriately be called an appeal tribunal, which is actually what this function seems to be doing, and it's purely a confusion issue in the marketplace. In terms of the 50% directors, our traditional corporate model based on the British system is that all directors are approved by the shareholders, normally at a general meeting or an annual general meeting. The American model is that they can be appointed and they become a self-perpetuating board. So the board appoints itself and it just continues appointing itself. If the board requires certain skills and it needs to appoint those, then they would still have to be approved at the next annual general meeting, stand for re-election, or alternatively they are not elected. So in effect, all 100% of the directors would need to be appointed and approved by the shareholders. The bill currently provides that at least 50% must be appointed by and approved by the shareholders. So de facto, the other 50% are appointed. How? We don't know. Presumably by somebody like the minister. The challenge is that that particular section does not apply to state-owned enterprises. But it may be just a drafting error that the definition or the text that excludes state-owned enterprises, where the ministers appoint or the directors appointed by the government, which is incidentally also the shareholder. So it's just a question of clarity around why that provision is there, that at least 50% should be appointed. We would argue that 100% need to be appointed and approved by shareholders. The question of are there enough resources, and that is the basis of our submission, is we do not believe there are these resources out there waiting to become supervisor or be appointed as supervisor. They are not judicial managers, they are not liquidators, because traditionally the entire existing body of judicial managers and supervisors have been focused on winding up a company, on liquidation, on realizing the assets and paying out dividends to the creditors and shareholders. They have not been geared to try to manage a company through financial distress into success and an ongoing business. So these practical, experienced business managers, no longer consultants, they are probably going to be consultants who now have to become de facto managers. It's going to be different than offering advice on the sideline and then walking away. We don't believe they are there. We certainly don't believe they're there in the numbers that may be required, because this is an alternative to going into liquidation and insolvency. And it is like the statutory debt counselling that interposes itself in individuals. So yes, the experience of the National Credit Act is that there were not enough statutory debt counsellors, and the credit granting industries had to put in an alternative, complementary process of voluntary debt mediation to try and resolve the large numbers of people who are seeking to be addressed by that system.
Thank you very much. Good folks, I propose that we adjourn for lunch until 1:30.